Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello, Critic listeners, and welcome back to another podcast from The Critic magazine. This week, Graham Stewart speaks to Nick Timothy on liberalism and Emeritus Professor of History, Jeremy Black, on the relationship between war and the state. Nick Timothy is former advisor to Theresa May and now a Daily Telegraph columnist, as well as author of Remaking One Nation, The Future of Conservatism.
A few years ago, it seemed we were all liberals. Perhaps many of us are still liberals. But the cause of liberalism in Britain and in many countries around the world seems to have taken a bit of a knock in recent years. Who better to discuss the future of liberalism than Nick Timothy, the author of Remaking One Nation, The Future of Conservatism? Nick, welcome to the Critic podcast. I want to start by asking you whether you would accept this analysis that actually the high watermark of liberalism in Britain and in many Western countries is now receding fast.
Well, I think we're probably, there's always a risk when we're talking about liberalism that liberalism can mean absolutely anything or something very specific. And I mean, I think to some extent we are all liberals in the West if we believe in checks and balances on government, on a free an independent media, an independent judiciary, and so on. Then the sort of, I call this essential liberalism in my book. We are all or almost all adherents to those beliefs. I think the danger is where liberalism I think becomes more ideological. It ceases to be a philosophy that that recognizes and values pluralism and takes on more ideological forms. And I think it's liberalism in that sense that is starting to come under pressure. So on one hand, we have a kind of elite liberalism where you have politicians from across the party divides who believe in things that, to be honest, majorities of voters often don't, whether that's high immigration or the marketisation of public services. It can be from what we think of as right and left. And then there's also, in the book, I describe of ultra-liberalism, which takes in different kinds of beliefs. So on the right, you have these kinds of market fundamentalists who want to sort of privatize everything and think mainly of the economy. And on the left, you have these kind of cultural liberals who push this sort of aggressive and militant identity politics. And what tends to happen is they both ratchet liberalism and individualism further along, because while they do disagree about what each side is doing, they quite often actually just accept the policies that have been left by the other side and then pursue their own ultra-liberal agendas. And so we end up with this kind of the policy consequences of that are sort of an atomized society, a lot of individualism, social problems, economic problems, and then perversely for people on the right, a big state that grows as it tries to fix some of those problems. So I think it's liberalism at its more ideological ends that is now under pressure.
This is a liberalism you would associate with the government of David Cameron and Nick Clegg. Would you say that resembled almost the high watermark of both liberalism in terms of globalization and also liberalism in terms of social attitudes? Or if you were trying to rank conservative prime ministers, let's say from Thatcher to Johnson, in order of their liberalism, how would you do that? Who would come top and who would come bottom?
Cool, that's quite a difficult question. I think the jury is out on Boris a little bit at the moment. I mean, you know, he's definitely a liberal in the sense that, you know, he supported things like equal marriage in the past. He was pretty socially liberal mayor of London. He's certainly talked about things like amnesties for illegal immigrants. But the interesting thing about the position he's in at the moment is he, having backed and effectively led the Leave campaign and then became leader of the Conservative Party and prime minister with the mission to get Brexit done, He obviously lost the support of some Remain supporting former Conservatives in more southern and prosperous constituencies, and he had to build a new electoral coalition that could give him a majority in Parliament. And he succeeded in doing that. And that electoral coalition obviously comprises far more working class and provincial voters than the Conservatives have had historically, which I think takes him away from the kind of economic liberalism that the Conservatives have pursued in the past. And obviously that was behind his levelling up agenda, his promises to invest in infrastructure and spend on schools and hospitals and the police. And I think as we come out of this crisis, and of course we do have this sort of, these massive fiscal consequences of the lockdown, I think we're unlikely to see a sort of second age of austerity, precisely because it is unsustainable for the new Conservative electoral coalition. So Boris is quite an interesting example, because I think in practice we're likely to see him lead the Tory party away from some of its economically liberal assumptions. The coalition, I think you mentioned that, I think that probably is a good example of the elite liberalism I just described, where you have you have people like Nick Clegg and George Osborne, and you have to ask what they actually disagree about. They both stand for this kind of elite liberal agenda, and you could almost imagine them being in a party led by Tony Blair. It sort of demonstrates the way in which these views are held across the party spectrum.
And I mean, Margaret Thatcher, I'm simplifying her position a little bit, but essentially you would describe her as an economic liberal, but a social conservative. So that almost suggests that Boris Johnson is the reverse of Margaret Thatcher. He's a social liberal, but increasingly tempted towards being an economic conservative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly right about the economics. I think the question about social liberalism is quite an interesting one, because firstly, we have to you can break it down into different sort of subjects, I suppose. But is Boris a social liberal if he uses the opportunity of Brexit to control immigration? So we said that in the past he's talked about an amnesty for illegal immigrants. He's now promising a new immigration system to bring a different kind of control to that area. So on social liberalism, you have to consider things like that, but you also then have to look at things like what does support for the family mean in this day and age? Now, back in the post-war period, and maybe even in the 1980s, under Mrs. Thatcher, we might have thought that support for their family had to mean things like recognising marriage in the tax system, transferable tax allowances between spouses. These days, support for the family actually probably needs to reflect the fact that modern families come in all shapes and sizes, and that you're not helping lots of families with lots of need for support, but also with some durability, if you're only targeting people who are already married. And so I think, you could see that the government might be socially conservative in the sense that it is doing much more to promote stability in family households, but isn't necessarily doing it through the old sense of what a, in inverted commas, good family looks like.
Where would Theresa May be on your liberalometer?
I think having worked for Theresa for quite a long time, I think having finished my stint working for her, I'm probably as nonplussed about some of her beliefs as the rest of the country have been. I think she always used to say she wasn't especially ideological, but she had conservative principles and sort of applied them on a kind of case by case basis. I mean, I think the original pitch that she made to the country in the Conservative leadership campaign of 2016, and then the first year of her premiership when I worked for her, I think was about trying to provide a corrective to the to the excesses of liberalism in the way that we've discussed. So it was much more about using the power of the state to assist in the sort of regional rebalancing of the economy through industrial strategy, and you know, the state playing a much more strategic role in the economy. She was, you know, much more prepared to talk about intervening in markets where they appeared dysfunctional. Back then, of course, she took a more skeptical view of Chinese investment, which she subsequently changed her mind on, I think. So I think in that period, it was all about an attempt to probably overturn some of the aspects of the liberal consensus that we're talking about. But then obviously things were somewhat derailed after the election, and I think she focused mainly on sort of managing her way through each day and week, and it wasn't an especially strategic period.
We're now in an interesting situation caused through coronavirus, which is leading to a very fundamental rethink about the Conservative Party's relationship with the state. I mean, the Conservative Party has embraced the NHS in a way which seems almost remarkable. It's been prepared to put the entire economy into a coma in order to save the NHS. I wonder to what extent the popularity that comes from doing that, and that popularity may prove ephemeral, but for the moment the popularity of doing that will rub off and make the Conservatives actually the party of an active and interventionist state, perhaps along the model of the Singaporean People's Action Party.
Yeah, well, I think there's quite a lot to unpack there. I mean, I think... I mean, popularity is only ever ephemeral by definition, because the very nature of government is making difficult decisions, and there are going to be some pretty difficult decisions in the times ahead. I think the choice between sort of saving the NHS, as it were, and keeping the economy going in a way is less binary than it's sometimes presented. I think if we hadn't locked down and the NHS had been overwhelmed and there had been a very, much more severe spike, then I think the economic consequences would have been, if anything, worse. But I think the decision to lock down was the right one. I think there'll be a post-mortem in time when we come to consider some of the right and wrong decisions that have been taken. But the decision to lock down seemed like the right one to me. But the point about politics is, I think, voters never say thank you for what you've done. They always ask what's next. Boris's hero is Winston Churchill, and he's probably the most famous example of not being thanked for the Second World War and the voters asking what's next. With things like universal public services and the welfare state in mind. And we know what's next. The thing that's next is how on earth we get the economy going again. And as I say, I mean, I think the way in which ministers will try to get the economy going again will not be anything very much like the sort of 2010-15 Parliament, where the response from George Osborne was to try to shrink the state and cut spending. I think they will pursue growth. They will try to double down on their investment plans in the regions. And I think it's, apart from the fact that that is already the kind of shape of their approach, I think it's quite hard for ministers to spend a period of crisis talking about a great collective effort and talking up the power of the state to then return to the politics and economics and language of individualism and liberalism. So my expectation is that there will be an economic policy that relies on the state playing a strategic role.
One of the criticisms that has been made of liberal conservatism is that it allows everything to be up for sale. Ultimately, the Conservatives claim to be the party of institutions, but if there's a price on it, they'll sell it. I remember during David Cameron's government, I mean, even a massive British company, BAE Systems, of huge defence strategic importance. It looked as if the government was prepared to allow that to be sold. As it happened, it fell through. But there appeared to be no absolute prohibition of that happening. I sense now, particularly the music coming about, alarm about a predatory Chinese takeover of strategically significant British companies. I suggest that there is a rethink going on. Is this smoke and mirrors, or actually, other than maybe a few high-profile cases, is a totally unlimited approach to globalization? If there's a price on it, it's for sale. Is the Conservatives retreating from that form of liberalism?
Well, I think there are probably two different things, aren't there? I mean, firstly, there is the question of Chinese investment in our economy or investment from other states that we believe to be hostile to our interests and values. And it feels like it's probably quite certain now that the government will change policies to probably block certain forms of Chinese investment, to keep them away from elements of our critical national infrastructure, and in particular Chinese ownership of innovative technological companies. All of that, I think, is welcome and right, and we shouldn't allow ourselves to be so exposed to one particular country, and in particular one country whose values and interests are so wildly different to our own. But then I think there's a second question about the extent to which government says, well, there are certain strategically important parts of our economy that we don't want to see fall into either foreign ownership or the kind of ownership that we'll see asset stripping and that kind of thing. And, you know, you mentioned BAE Systems. During the coalition years, there was also a takeover bid from Pfizer to buy AstraZeneca, which the government for a period looked like it was likely to allow to happen. And in the end, like with BAE, it didn't. But, if you take AstraZeneca, I mean, AstraZeneca is one of the most important companies in Britain, in the sense that if you want to have an industrial strategy and you think there should be some kind of manufacturing base in Britain and a research base in Britain, then our pharmaceutical industry is probably the most important part of that. And within the pharmaceutical industry, AstraZeneca is vitally important. So if you're prepared to let a firm like AstraZeneca be sold to a firm like Pfizer, which has a long history of buying companies for tax purposes, asset stripping, and so on, then you don't have an industrial strategy, and you are clearly pursuing a sort of a very hands-off market-based approach. And I think so the question now is, yes, the government seems to be shifting its policy in terms of Chinese investment, but to what extent will it be interventionist in a much broader sense because it believes in maintaining an industrial base in Britain?
And in that debate in cabinet, how do you see the forces dividing?
I mean, in a sense, I suppose it may be too early to say. I mean, before the crisis, we had the bailout of Flybe, which is not the same as takeovers, obviously, but it was an interesting example of an intervention that I don't think we'd have seen from a Conservative government before. I think that was a sign of a shift in terms of ministers' attitudes to the state and assessing the value of a company that goes beyond the immediate sort of value to shareholders and so on. It was much more interested in the social utility of the kind of services that Flybe operated. So I think that is a definite sign that there has been a shift towards intervention. I mean, you can say so too as the policy response, the economic policy response to coronavirus, with the extent of the intervention there, like the furlough scheme and so on. I think that's harder to assess because it's this is a unique challenge, and we don't know how other governments would have responded. But I think my sense is that there is definitely a movement We don't know the extent of the movement yet, and we will see the extent to which the kind of free market wing of the Tory party reacts against it, and whether they try to fight it.
Who would be your tip as the person who would lead that liberal free market wing?
Well, I think it depends on how you're looking at it. So I think institutionally, the Treasury is obviously always sceptical of these kinds of interventions. So the Treasury itself will be interesting to watch. Inside the cabinet, I think we're yet to see for sure which way different ministers are likely to come down. So I think sometimes people characterise Rishi Sunak as slightly more sort of libertarian. I disagree with that. My sense is that he has a somewhat traditional Tory view of the economy, but is very mindful of the levelling up agenda and has a strong interest as a Northern MP himself in the rebalancing of the economy. And I think he's quite enthusiastic about the investment in the regions that has been announced. So I think he's a new-ish minister, so we'll need to watch the way his views evolve and the way he matures as a cabinet minister. We have Alok Sharma in the business department, who hasn't yet given some big speeches on how he sees industrial strategy developing, which is kind of understandable because he has his plate rather full at the moment. And so I think in the cabinet, this is another example of having to wait and see. I think on the backbenches, I think we've probably already seen Sajid Javid has started to fire some warning shots and make some speeches and written articles where he's kind of made the more Thatcherite case, if you like.
And I wonder where Boris Johnson will be in this debate, not just in terms of his own view, but whether he will be primus inter pares and sit back, relax, let the others argue it out, or whether he will decide on his line and try and drive it through cabinet.
Yeah, I mean, that's another interesting question, isn't it? Because, it's not like his number 10 so far has been sitting back and letting ministers decide. They've obviously been in the forefront of the things the government's been doing. And that's another thing to look at as we emerge from the worst of the pandemic crisis, because I think this will probably change institutional relationships as well as individual relationships inside government. So, Sajid quit as chancellor because he felt like he didn't have independence in the Treasury. Actually, I think what we're likely to see as this crisis goes on, and as we start to emerge from it, certainly the Treasury will sort of resume, I think, its role as the most important department in Whitehall, and then other ministers and other departments will inevitably have to stand up more than they did before, because the scale of the mission before them is so huge.
Given that there is an 80-seat majority, is it your view nevertheless that this is an exciting opportunity for the Conservative Party to roll back from some of the more liberal fundamentalist positions towards what you've described as a new one-nation approach?
I certainly thought that at the time of the election. I thought Boris's leadership and the electoral coalition he was seeking gave the party that opportunity. Him winning the majority was obviously huge. The fact that the party now represents parts of the country it never has before, I think probably suggested that the party was going to move in that kind of way. I think the party probably is going to be more interested in active government than it has been, and coronavirus probably makes that even more applicable. I guess the thing is, the question is whether you're trying, whether as we come out of the worst of this crisis, whether we see the task as creating something really exciting for the country's future, or whether it's about trying to rebuild something that has been burned to the ground. And it might be the case that ministers end up feeling like the job is difficult enough. They've got to restore things to the condition they were before, rather than trying to build something new. But I think a lot of people talking to ministers and advisors over the last couple of months, I think quite a lot of people in government are mindful that while this is difficult, while there's a lot of pain and suffering, there is always opportunity in a crisis, because it means that you can take measures that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to take, and you can build in ways that you might not have been able to before. And they do seem to be determined to stick to the kind of ambitions that they set for themselves in the election campaign in December.
Well, we'll see if they stay true to that course, or whether coronavirus blows them in a different direction. Dick Timothy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Huge events, be it a virus sweeping the world as a pandemic or major wars, have tremendous effects on all aspects of society, politics, economy, and the role of the state. Charles Tilly, the American sociologist, famously said, "War made the state, and the state made war." Professor Jeremy Black, is that an oversimplification?
Well, it's definitely an oversimplification, because many things made the state. But nevertheless, it captures the extent to which it's foolish to think of human history without seeing war as a major aspect of the development of states and societies, and also affected by that development. But the notion that other aspects, for example, changes in economic technology, were not important, or indeed, I mean, since we're sitting in what isn't a pandemic at all by the scale of something like the Black Death, but if you're thinking of major, really important episodes in the past of that type, they also clearly have had formative consequences.
And does it depend what period you take it from? I mean, if we look at the 20th century use of war, then would we have a different view if we looked at it during the 18th century?
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that possibly, the idea, the modern idea, of course, is that you get the age of total war in the 20th century, and that you didn't get total war onwards, but prior to that, and that, you know, there's this sort of developmental model towards a supposed modernity. I think that's deeply flawed. I mean, the practicality is, Athens at the end of the Peloponnesian War, or Tamburlaine and those who suffered his attacks, were every bit as much affected by total war as anything in the modern age. And I think there is this thing which you get more generally, which is the sort of the fantasy of so many military historians, that you've got a sort of series of revolutions taking you towards a new stage in the present and then on into the future, when in practice a lot of the elements of conflict, particularly civil conflict, and civil conflict is often one of the major types of conflict, are relatively, or change in a very different fashion. And so I think one's got to be very, very careful on that. And also, you know, if you take, let's say you take the 20th century, if you take Latin America, there have been singularly few state-to-state wars or conflicts since 1935, when the Grand Chaco War between Paraguay and Bolivia ended, and yet it would be foolish to say that, you know, those states and societies have not altered. So no, I think, Charles Tilly was, you know, a sociologist. He was making grand gestures, and a lot of these grand gestures sort of are rewarded by often very lazy, for example, reviewers in, you know, newspapers who want something simple to tick off, and publishers like grand titles and simple theses. But the nature of human society is that it is inherently complex, and in a way, precisely because there are more human beings than ever before, more of them are literate, and we have more independent states since the last 50 years than we had in the previous 50 years, you would expect a greater degree of complexity in the present. And those people that have tried to use aspects of modernization theory to say what they are referring to is modernity, and that's what you need to analyze, and, you know, war plays a certain role in it, I think one has to be very cautious about that.
So let's try and unpick some of the aspects in which there is a relationship between war and the state, and also get a sense of a chicken and egg in this. The role of credit, the simple ability of states to be able to fund big military operations. Should we see the development of financial services in certain countries as making them either keener to wage war on a large scale, or just more able to, or actually with these functions of credit, did they come from war itself?
Well, borrowing was certainly an important aspect of one's ability to fight. But it wasn't the only one, and you can, of course, have, I mean, you were thinking about total war at the outset, you can, in fact, have systems of warfare based on predation, raiding, which are quite fit for purpose, and which, of course, can be devastating. And, you know, there is an argument that there was that aspect in modern warfare. I mean, there's an argument that if you're looking at the Third Reich, despite all its supposed modernity, in many senses, it was an old-fashioned loot-and-steal military system. So I think one has to be quite careful, again, at looking at that. I mean, what I would say is this, that if given that society in the 20th century is more urbanized and industrialized than society, let us say, at the beginning of the 19th century, then clearly the impact of a state in wartime will have a more intensive effect in those urban and industrial contexts. And that, I think, is definitely the case. I was looking at a quote from John Monash, the Australian commander who visited London in 1916, and he wrote to his wife, at night the whole of London is in absolute darkness, and he underlined that because that was so striking. That was an example of, as it were, modern life, and what he's referring to is the fear of zeppelins. All games and museums are closed, nothing but war work everywhere. Everything is at famine prices. Nothing is going on in the ships, in the streets, anywhere that has not a direct bearing on the war. Martial law everywhere. No private motors allowed. No functions. No racing. Nothing I had read conveyed to me any idea of how the war had taken hold of the whole British nation, and how every man, woman, and child was bent on one sole purpose: to prosecute the war in every form of activity. Well, I mean, that certainly made a very abrupt impact on Monash, and I think it's fair to say that that degree of mobilization of a modern urban industrialized society was very notable, and we see the same thing obviously in World War II. But, you know, if you're going forward, I mean, Britain and the United States have fought expeditionary wars, whatever term you want to call them, in places such as variously, such as Iraq, Afghanistan, prior to that, in the case of the Americans, places like Somalia, without anybody having anywhere near that degree of mobilization. But for the other side, I mean, if you go back to the Americans in Vietnam, Vietnam becomes the most bombed city, the most bombed country in world history, but at the same time, without any comparable impact on of mobilization on the American home front. So I think in part it really depends upon what one's looking at. And you could argue, if you wanted to be interesting, you could say that World War I and World War II were in some respects relatively primitive systems geared to the particular nature of those societies and industrialized systems, whereas the idea that you might be able to fight a modern war without, in fact, conscripting everybody, and why should you want to conscript them? Most of them are physically unfit and mentally not necessarily up to handling modern weaponry. You might say that is a more modern, whatever you mean by modern in this context, system of war.
And I wonder how unusual the Second World War in particular, also the First World War, but particularly the Second World War as a citizens' war, a total war, was. If you compared it to, say, what European citizens would have experienced, what inconveniences they would have experienced during, let us say, the War of the Spanish Succession or the Napoleonic Wars, proportionately, would they be roughly similar? What ways would they find the state having a larger role in their lives?
Well, conscription, and conscription does require, let's put it this way, it's eased by a very comprehensive census system. Conscription is very much a characteristic that comes in when you have that desire for very large numbers of troops. I mean, there's always a interplay between those societies that are more interested in military professionalism and those that are interested in bulk. From that point of view, let us say French Revolutionary Wars, the introduction by the French of the levée en masse, which basically means male conscription, that is a very much more dramatic imposition, if you want to use those terms, on the citizenry than, shall we say, the Ancien Régime armies, which fundamentally were much more volunteer in their basis. Now, one's got to be careful about comparing past and present. If you had experienced injury and were dying of blood poisoning in 1800, given the nature of medical assistance, you were in a much worse situation than if you were injured in World War II, or even more today. So we should be wary of assuming that just because we use the vocabulary of war about the present day, that this necessarily makes modern warfare, or even the warfare of the world wars, more extreme. I mean, you know, what, for example, is one assuming by total war? If it was really total, you might be assuming large-scale organized cannibalism, but that wasn't a way that was used. So one's got to be very careful as to what one means by totality, and also to assume that it's necessary, you've got to be very careful of assuming that it's necessarily more modern. And as I said, you could argue the exact opposite, and I would have argued that the Third Reich is very much a very primitive system, and obviously in nature of its war making and also in the nature of its genocide.
And I wonder to what extent there is British exceptionalism here. You talked about the levée en masse and the long tradition of conscription in Europe, and also not just the devastation of the First and Second World Wars in Europe. You have the extraordinary devastation of the 30 Years' War, and you know, devastation in to greater or less extents in the wars of the 18th century and early 19th century as well. Britain isn't invaded, doesn't go in for this mass conscription, although of course there are press gangs and so on. Does that mean that the British state's relationship to British people during these periods of war has essentially been very different to that of European states?
Well, I think the key element was the rejection of both Cromwellian autocracy and Stuart autocracy. Each of those were associated with military rule and military ambition. They both failed, and the 18th century self-image of the British was that they were not obliged to fight in that fashion, or if they did fight, it was through volunteer militia. So that you had a small standing army that was very much seen as part of the British conception, and that of course remained the case during the long 19th century. I mean, you know, there are significant differences in public culture between that of Britain and that of many European states. There's no doubt at all about that. And conscription is an important element of it. But the British are not unique in not having conscription. Of course, in 19th century America, which in many senses is another form of the British political world, or at least from its origins, there isn't conscription until it's briefly introduced in the Civil War and then immediately removed. So there is a sense that the state's power over the citizenry should be confined and restricted. Now that, of course, is altered during both world wars, and as a result of which you have Defence of the Realm Acts, you have much more comprehensive intervention, and I was quoting Monash to talk about that. But that doesn't mean that that was, as it were, accepted as a sort of anything other than a wartime expedient, just as, of course, income tax or Britain going off the gold standard had both been introduced as wartime expedients during the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars and had then been, reversed subsequently. I mean, what I'd say is interesting about the 20th century is that the Defence of the Realm Act of 1914 and the Emergency Powers Defence Act of 1939, they both brought, controls and the habit of control. But the habit of control proved more insistent and lasting than had been intended. And this was particularly so after World War II. Now, after World War I, I think it's fair to say that a liberal society was reintroduced as rapidly as possible. After World War II, this was not the case. I mean, conscription continued, rationing continued, and it was very much a top-down approach to political and social organization. So you get an attempt at enforced modernization through centralized means, which is one way of describing the social and political policies of the Labour governments of 1945 to 51. And in some respects, that is a classic example of trying to take wartime powers into peacetime. Now, what's interesting is that obviously some people were prepared to accept that. I mean, Attlee gets re-elected the first time round, but there was also widespread sort of attempts at evasion and avoidance from, industrial disputes, and of course the Labour government had to send troops into the docks to deal with that, to the fact that for a lot of people they didn't like rationing, and the black market rested essentially on the strength of an informal economy in which a large number of people felt that it was appropriate to evade what they thought of as unfair and unreasonable regulations of the state. And in any society, whoever is the government, you have to be very careful and cautious about making illegal what people regard as reasonable. It's my sort of speed driving test, and I don't drive, incidentally, but if you ask most people do they defy the law, most of them will tell you that they don't. And if you say to them, well, does this mean that you never speed? Then most of them will say, well, of course I speed. I'll drive at 30 in a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit because I know the roads and it's perfectly safe when I'm doing it. And they will make it quite clear, though, that they wouldn't drive, the vast majority of them, at 50 or 60 on those roads. So in other words, they have internalized what they think of as a fair set of regulations. Now, the problem is when government tries to push that too far. And I think it's fair to say that in wartime there was an understanding of this, not least because there was a sense that a large part of the male population were risking their lives, therefore having restrictions on the home front was acceptable and necessary, and not least because the Germans were trying to bomb the shit out of the British. So in a sense that this also seemed acceptable and necessary. But this was not the same after 1945, and I think it's fair to say that disillusionment with Labour and Labour's policies of regulation increased during that period. And it's one of the reasons why I think a lot of the sort of subsequent eulogization of Attlee is really very misleading.
It's understandable, therefore, that the public will put up with restrictions and controls when there is a common purpose, such as a war, and therefore understandable also that during the times of peace in the second half of the 1940s, some of the war socialism would become less appealing. But which are the aspects, Professor Black, would you say, of war socialism that lasted well beyond 1945, actually lasted because they enjoyed considerable popular support?
Well, I mean, I think the social policies that led to changes in national insurance and in health provision were the ones that were to last. But I think they were popular. I think one's got to be careful here. As we know, the nature of British elections and British politics, we are not a plebiscitary state, which is one of the things that caused upset when there was a series of referenda from the 1970s onwards. Whether we should or shouldn't be, whether it's a direct democracy is or isn't a good idea, we can discuss on another occasion. But what I mean is you've got to be very careful as a historian to assume or presume as to what at any one moment people found acceptable or unacceptable. So let's take conscription. Most conscripts served. There was, relatively little in the terms of draft avoidance, not that it would have been easy in the nature of that state and with family example behind in front of them. But we don't necessarily believe that that meant there was widespread enthusiasm for many of the tasks which British governments, first Labour and then Conservative, sort of sought to foster with a large-scale armed forces. And we've got to be very careful at judging that or assuming that. And also there's a big difference between what might be a grudging consent, what might be enthusiasm, what might be an attempt to avoid things, doctor, I've got flat feet kind of thing, and what might be a more active attempt to evade responsibility. So all of these, we've got to be very careful as historians. And the idea of having a black and white, yes, people were enthusiastic about that. No, they weren't enthusiastic about the other. We've got to be careful about. Same with rationing. I mean, it's quite clear that there was, an acceptance that rationing is something you had to put up with. It's also quite clear a lot of people didn't like it and relished any opportunity, whether growing things themselves, gathering things, pilfering stuff, whatever, to as it were, exceed the ration. So we've got to be very, very, very careful. It does seem to be the case that the enthusiasm in the 1950s, in which people embraced a culture in which material goods were very much to the fore, white goods, washing machines and such like, the motor car, advertisements on the new ITV stations. I think that's very interesting as a comment on the 1940s, as is the fact that, conservative governments were elected with very substantial majorities, despite the, shall we say, lackluster, to put it bluntly or mildly, policies of Eden, and the extent to which Macmillan in some respects was a vacuous windbag, but nevertheless they seemed much more attractive. And the notion of we're going to deal with the problems, we are going to give you material goods, we don't want the state simply to regulate, was very, very attractive. And if you want to wind forward to the present day, it is very, very difficult, I would have thought, for anybody, management consultants, politicians, civil servants, to work out what will be the cross currents of the public mode coming and mood coming out of, as one hopes we will do, a long period of lockdown whenever that occurs, because there will be some people who will regard the lockdown as a necessary response to a high death rate and pressures on the National Health Service, and other people will regard it as a ludicrous imposition on them when they didn't feel that, maybe because they were young or whatever, that they were in any particular risk, but in the meantime their jobs are being wrecked or their chance of being treated for cancer or just toothache are going. So both of those will probably play a role, and the danger will be, if you're some future historian, is it's all too easy, and I'm afraid to say there are many people that don't write very good history, it is all too easy to focus on one rather than the other. And the particular problem here, since we are talking about historical method, is the notion of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. The idea is that people in some way think in a certain fashion, and one has to be very careful about that. Now, a lot of people, a lot of commentators, a lot of politicians will claim to identify, reflect, and express the zeitgeist. And of course, there's also good commercial advantages if you're in the business world or the political world to do so. But the practicality in any sophisticated society is that there are a variety of moods and views and habits coexisting, often not coexisting terribly easily, and that each one tries to shape the general situation so as to present themselves as the norm, but we have to be very wary of assuming that that's the case.
So, as ever, cause and effect are among the most troublesome problems for historians to face. We'll have to leave it there. Professor Jeremy Black, as ever, a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.